From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain, sitting in for Terry Gross. After many years as a journalist, Ward Just decided to stop writing facts and start writing fiction. In the years since then, Just has written several critically acclaimed novels. On this edition of Fresh Air, novelist Ward Just talks about his new book, The Translator. Also today, actress Claire Bloom talks with us about bringing some of literature's great women to life. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz celebrates the 100th anniversary of Prokofiev's birth. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel from Anne Tyler. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations announced today that the government of El Salvador and leftist rebels have reached an agreement aimed at ending the country's 12-year civil war. The agreement provides for rebel guerrillas to be integrated into an independent civilian police force that will help protect them from army reprisals. The Salvadoran government has also agreed to give rebels and their families title to lands they are now holding and to abide by a constitutional land reform program. The two sides have been meeting at UN headquarters in New York for the past 10 days. France and Belgium sent troops into the capital of Zaire today to help escort Europeans trapped by rioting soldiers. Some Zairean troops mutinied this week in Kinshasa, saying they hadn't been paid in months. Ofabia Quist-Arkton filed this report for the BBC on the hundreds of refugees who fled across the border into the Congo.
About 300 people, women, children, and men, came off two ferries which had transported them from the Zairean capital, Kinshasa, visible across the river from neighboring Congo. They all looked tired and drawn. Many were shocked and distraught, but no one appeared hurt. Most were Europeans, French, Belgian, Italian, Portuguese, and Greek. There were also Canadians and Africans from Mali, Namibia, and Congo. They all told a similar story. Sounds of gunfire in the early hours of Monday morning, followed by riots on the streets of Kinshasa, led by armed soldiers. They were soon joined by civilians. Those fleeing Zaire say although the situation now appears calmer in Kinshasa, the city is a wreck, with shops, businesses, and people's homes totally ransacked.
Ofabia Quist-Arkton reporting for the BBC. There are reports that four people have been killed overnight in the Soviet Republic of Georgia, where a state of emergency went into effect today. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
According to Georgia's besieged president, Zviad Gamsakhurdia, the four were killed in a gunfight last night near a power station in Tbilisi, Georgia's capital. Gamsakhurdia told reporters on the scene that rebel National Guardsmen, opposed to his government, had attacked the power station in order to cut power to downtown Tbilisi. In the gunfight that ensued, two of the guardsmen and two local police defending the station were killed, according to the president. Gamsakhurdia accused the rebels and the opposition activists who have occupied a local TV station since Sunday of mounting a coup against him in the Georgian parliament. The opposition says it wants access to TV, which Gamsakhurdia recently withdrew. Its demands also include a release of political prisoners. There have been demonstrations in Tbilisi against Gamsakhurdia every day for several weeks. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Stock prices were down slightly today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points to close at 3,021. Declines edged advances in moderate trading. Volume on the New York Exchange was 154 million shares. This is NPR. The United Nations Security Council has imposed a mandatory arms embargo on Yugoslavia and called for an end to the fighting in the secessionist Republic of Croatia. Earlier today, Croatia's foreign minister criticized the UN plan because it doesn't provide for a UN peacekeeping force to help enforce the ceasefire. Zvonimir Separovic said that an arms embargo will actually be to the advantage of well-equipped federal troops. Secretary of State James Baker told the Security Council today that the Federal Army and the Republic of Serbia are guilty of aggression against Croatia. It's believed to be the first time in history a rabbi has sued a high official of the Catholic Church. Rabbi Avraham Weiss, who staged a protest at a convent outside Auschwitz in 1989, has served papers on Polish Cardinal Josef Glemp during Glemp's tour of the United States. Karen DeWitt of New York Public Radio reports.
In 1989, Rabbi Avi Weiss traveled with several of his students from the Bronx to Poland to protest the presence of a Carmelite convent built near the site of the Nazi death camp at Auschwitz. Weiss was arrested and charged with trespassing. In response, Cardinal Glemp delivered a homily in which Weiss attorney Alan Dershowitz says Glemp slandered Weiss.
Cardinal Glemp made a speech in which he accused Rabbi Weiss of coming to Poland to kill nuns and to destroy the convent at Auschwitz, when he full well knew that Rabbi Weiss had come with students to conduct a prayer vigil.
Glemp has apologized twice for his remarks. Neither Glemp or Catholic Church officials in Albany, where Glemp was attending a service, had any comment on the lawsuit. For National Public Radio, I'm Karen DeWitt in Albany.
The nation's industrial sector suffered a setback last month as orders for durable goods took a sharp drop. The Commerce Department said that orders for durable goods slipped by 3.8% in August, with weaker demand in almost every category of finished product. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Ward Just covered Vietnam for The Washington Post, and more than most reporters, he caught the absurdities of the war. David Halberstam said this about Ward Just: perhaps no reporter wrote as well from Vietnam with as much subtlety and grace as he did. But Just began to question whether the larger truths of war and politics got lost in the details of daily reporting. Eventually, Just lost his taste for journalism, and he quit the Post to write novels. Herbert Mitgang in the New York Times writes, Ward Just left daily journalism some 20 years ago, and lucky for lovers of distinguished fiction, turned his talents to novels and short stories. He is one of the few modern journalists who has leaped the wall between the two crafts successfully. He has emerged as one of the most astute writers of American fiction. Ward Just lives in Paris now and has just completed his latest novel, The Translator. It's the story of Sidney Van Damme, a German who lives in Paris, where he works as a translator. Van Damme's father was an officer in Hitler's Third Reich. The book explores a theme that Just has written about before, the loyalty between fathers and sons, and a son's responsibility to his father's past.
Sidney Van Damme happens to be exactly my age. There's no particular reason for that, except it's easier for me to get the time sequences straight. He's 55.
Mm-hmm.
Look at a German who's 55. It means they're born in 1935. 5 years old when the war commenced, 10 years old when the war ended. No complicity in the Third Reich. A five-year-old can't have a complicity in that. And yet, the consequences of that, the burden of memory, the weight of history, are borne by the youngsters. They're borne by people who were not complicit, but must live with the consequences. This is not true not only in Germany, but for the rest of us. You're always bearing the consequences, often, of things that you neither started nor finished, but somehow the consequences are yours, and that's what struck me as interesting about Sidney.
Well, I think what's difficult for a child, as you say, that is truly a child then during World War II, is that you're right, he lived in Germany. He wasn't the architect of German's policy,
right,
but he had parents. And in this case, he had a father who, although he wasn't a Nazi, was part of the regime.
A staff officer in the Wehrmacht.
Well, it's an impossible task you've set out for this.
That's right. That's right. It's excruciating. And Sidney's solution to it was to simply expatriate himself from Germany and go to live in Paris. And one of the things that the book spins around are these terrible arguments that he has with his mother, who is a very tough woman indeed, who believes that when you leave your country, you lose your soul. She says, "To live in a foreign country is a terrible fate." She believes that you uproot yourself. You no longer have you can no longer live in the way that you should. You have no more roots, and you're sort of floating free, and nobody cares about you. When you become inconvenient, you will be thrown away, she says.
Is this a kind of a theme that you've been playing with in a number of your novel? I'm thinking of The Ambassador, where a father has to sort of choose between a son and his country. In Jack Lance, a father sent to prison for tax evasion.
Yes.
That somehow children have to try to not answer for their parents, but sort of do have to answer for their parents.
Indeed, and in the case of the ambassador, That's a trick that goes both ways, because in this case, it's not only the sins of the father visited upon the son, but vice versa. And that was the way I was trying to set that up. I've always been, in all my work, I've been interested in people who are dislocated, who start off one place and end someplace else. But the one thing that they've got to begin with is the rejection of the native ground.
Are countries then, in a sense, surrogate parents?
Yeah, I've always had a thought. I've often looked at it the other way around, that a family is a kind of a surrogate country. I've always had a thought that a family, if you think about a family, it really does have its own sort of laws. It has its own economic policy. One family's economic policy will not be another family's economic. It has its own language. It has its own cuisine.
Its own territory.
It's its own territory, which it defends, or not, depending on the case. So I've always thought of it like that, and I've thought of it more that way than the other way around, but the other way around is also true.
I'm wondering in this book whether you're trying to make a connection between the kind of guilt that both America and Germany feel towards their particular past and even towards their particular wars. The reason I ask that is that Sidney Van Damme has a past associated with Germany in World War II. His wife is trying to recover from the fact that her brother was killed in Vietnam.
Yes.
And whether you feel, and Vietnam is a war that you covered, whether you feel that these two countries, America and Germany, share some kind of guilt about the wars that they have fought.
I think that this is true. In a larger sense, I think that we all live in a political context. The way any American lived in 1980, in the 1980s, was different than the way they lived in the 1950s. And in part, that was because of Reagan. That you lived in a different way because of the political context of the times. In the more specific case of these two, the Vietnam War was not the monstrosity of the Third Reich. These are not equivalents. But it was bad enough, and it was a depredation, in my view, so outside the sort of normal the parameters of American behavior over the years. Not that American behavior has always been that wonderful, but this seems to me to be quite a departure.
You covered Vietnam
yeah.
For the Washington Post in, I think, it's 67, 68, 69.
66 and 67.
Your report seemed to have an eye and an ear for the kind of absurdities of the war.
Yeah.
That seemed to be what you noticed there. Were there some writing lessons then from being a war correspondent that influences your writing as a novelist?
Yes. The extremity of a combat situation, the violence of it, the look of it, the human consequence of it, it seems to be so important. It is such a profound event that you feel a tremendous responsibility to the material to get it right. Not to fuss around with it, not to in other things, in political correspondence, you can get a little cheap from time to time. You better damn well not be cheap in a combat situation when you're writing. There just seems to be too much at stake, and it, in some strange way, I think it teaches you responsibility to the craft somehow. Because it's so important. It's not some nitwit on the stump, you know, giving some stupid speech. This is the real thing. People are dying. And as you try to describe the nature of a battle, you better damn well get it right.
But can you get it right? And you seem to have come back from that war with a deep suspicion of the facts.
Yes.
And there's something that you say, I think it's in your novel, Jack Glantz, the truth was a forest of facts, and the facts were in the shadows. And if you could describe the shadows, you had the truth.
Yeah, that's what I truly believed, particularly about war correspondence. That there's a way to describe the atmosphere of violence that did not depend on getting the name, rank, and serial number. It depended on the off quote, not the quote that was going to tell you how many meters were advanced that day, but the quote that somehow got to the underbelly of the situation. And frankly, you could do a lot with quotations. I mean, interviews, you could, if you're trying to describe something, you can move the thing a little bit from here to there. But the principal thing was a description, getting the description of the terrain right, and particularly the attitude of the deaths. I had a particular task when I was there. I was working for the Washington Post, and I knew damn well that whatever the common reader might think about these dispatches, they were also being read in the Pentagon. And I felt an absolute responsibility to let them know as they were moving pins, their little pins forward on the maps, exactly what that was doing in the front line. So I sort of took it upon myself to get as far into that as I could, and try to write it as well as I could without. I never used novelistic techniques. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have to. It isn't necessary in an atmosphere of that kind of violence. The material is so rich, you don't have to stretch to describe it the way it ought to be described.
You were wounded in that war. Mm. You were hit by shrapnel, yeah. And I believe you were with a platoon or a company,
yes,
that many people died,
yes,
around you, and
yes,
certainly,
yes,
were wounded. Do you still have shrapnel in you,
yes,
from,
yes,
that war?
It extrudes from time to time, little tiny little bits and pieces. And it will. I mean, it, you know, sort of forever. It was, you know, kind of a shredded situation. But it's not. I mean, it's no big deal. It just happens.
My guest is Ward Just, and he's written a number of novels. His latest one is called The Translator, and Ward Just is a former Vietnam correspondent and was a journalist in Washington, D.C., both writing for The Washington Post. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Ward Just is my guest. I'm wondering, as a journalist, and even the way you talk about war coverage, I feel like there still is a journalist inside you somehow. When you see the events of the world happening, I'm thinking not just Eastern Europe, but certainly the Soviet Union and even the war in the Persian Gulf, whether part of you wants to go out and cover it.
No. I get an offer from time to time. Somebody, you know, why don't you go back and, you know, sort of do this or do that? And I don't have much confidence anymore in my ability to separate the fact. I mean, the objective fact of the thing, as opposed to sort of what I think about it. And for a newspaper, it isn't important what I think about. I mean, a newspaper reporter ought to have the fact. I mean, you use your words kind of as this. That's the clear pane of window glass that you can see the animals inside. I mean, then that's what the words are, the glass, and the animals are inside, and you're not creating wavy lines, and you're not using colored glass here and clear glass there. The whole thing has got to be clear glass. And I don't have any confidence in my ability to do that, and I'm not eager to do it. I don't. You know, a lot of friends of mine, because I hang out with a lot of newspaper people, were down in the Gulf, and I thought, God, what an awful assignment! I mean, not only is there no Bordeaux at the end of the day, but there are no facts either. I mean, there's no story at the end of the day except what some colonel is telling you. So,
well, let me quote you to you.
Yeah,
and this is
hey,
and this is an article. Actually, it was in the U.S. News and World Report a couple of years ago. And this is talking about journalists in Washington, but I think you seem to be talking about journalism in general. You say, more often than not, Washington journalists deal with an event as if it were a loose football that everyone piles on. There's a huge pile-on on a tiny fact while the ball squirts here and there. With all the journalism that's been done on Richard Nixon, for example, there's still a piece of his psyche missing somewhere, and it will remain forever mysterious until some latter-day Shakespeare creates a character much like him that will somehow explain Nixon to us. What you seem to be saying is that fiction can somehow get to the truth easier than journalism can.
Well, it's interesting. I don't often believe what I said in the past, but as Ben Bradley would say, I'll stand beside that. We know as much as we know about Nixon, only because of journalism, because of the work that's been done over the years. From the very earliest days of his career, 1946, that's how long he's been with us now. We only know what we know because of journalism. With any of us, there is this piece missing. You, me, you know who, George Bush, Jimmy Carter. There has to be. Otherwise, we're all just kind of robots. Yeah. And I think that what happens is that somebody will create a character, and his name will not be Richard Nixon. He'll call him something else, and this character will be drawn in such a way. And maybe it'll come in 100 years or 50 years time or 20 years time. Those of us who are alive and sort of knew Nixon in the early days will say, "My God, that's it. That's what he was like. It's not him. It's the shadow of him, but the outline drawn so well that you say, all right, that's what it was."
Can I ask you about your smoking?
My smoking.
Let me tell you what I want to ask you about that. Because
why would I do such a thing to myself?
No. I'm not here to reprimand you. But to talk about the difference between smoking in this country and smoking in France.
The country seems to me to be obsessed with cigarette smoking. You get on an airplane, and there are about 5 announcements. I mean, you know, stop smoking on no smoking materials of any kind. Don't even think about smoking in the John, because there are smoke detectors in the airplane. People will come and arrest you, and you'll be thrown in the jug 2 to 10 in Danville, making license plates and the signs, "Thank you for not smoking. Please don't smoke. Don't even think about smoking here." It's just a damned cigarette. I mean, it's not as if you're trying to commit murder. Going to get a lot of letters.
Yeah.
Going to get a lot of letters over that statement.
do you sort of have to sneak around in this country?
Oh, yeah.
And that you're kind of a pariah. I mean, no one wants to talk to you or sit next to you.
That's right. People are very, I have some dear friends who we'd be having dinner, you know, and with a tremendous sigh. They're very nice. They're very nice to do it. They will put down an ashtray next to my place, and they'll say, "All right, the dinner's over. Light them up if you really feel you must." And as you know, in France, people love to smoke. They do nothing but smoke. Americans go to France now, and the tourist bureau is not going to like me for saying this, and they're appalled because the French restaurants don't have no smoking sections. French smoke like chimneys all the time, during meals, between courses. There's one guy who loves to eat at a little restaurant than I do. He always eats there alone. He smokes between bites of his of his cassoulet while he's having a little wine along with it. It's a kind of a freer, you know.
Well, I think in this country we say this man has a disease.
That's the disease
of addiction.
In this country you say this man is addicted. He's committing suicide. That is too funny.
Well, have you ever tried to give up?
Yes. I got hypnotized once.
Did it work?
I worked for a month. The physical consequences were so disastrous. I will not go into all of them, but the physical consequences were so disastrous, I said, to hell with it. And that was 10 years ago. I probably will try it again in some more serious form, because I'm getting to the age where you probably shouldn't smoke as much as I do. But by God, I sure do enjoy it. That's what I do when I write all the time, you know, 2 packs a day.
About
2 packs a day. Camel Straits.
The hard stuff.
That's, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it, right?
Well, I really enjoyed talking with you today.
The very same.
And I thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Wardjust's latest novel is called The Translator. ...1991 is the bicentennial of Mozart's death, but this year is also the 100th anniversary of the birth of Sergei Prokofiev. Lloyd Schwartz, our classical music critic, celebrates that occasion with some comments on a recent release of Prokofiev playing his own music.
Prokofiev may not have been the greatest composer of the 20th century, but he may have been one of the most influential, not so much with other composers, but with audiences. After all, Peter and the Wolf may have introduced more children to classical music than any other composition. Of course, Prokofiev also wrote symphonies, concertos, and chamber music, operas, ballets, and film scores. Among his most delightful pieces is his third piano concerto, which he worked on between 1917 and 1921, and used themes that went back even further. He played the world premiere of the third piano concerto in Chicago. In 1932, he recorded it in London. The London Symphony Orchestra is under the direction of the unjustly neglected Italian conductor Piero Coppola. Prokofiev was obviously a brilliant pianist. Poulenc said that his fingers held the keyboard as a racing car holds the track. In his autobiography, Prokofiev wrote about what he called the four lines in his work: the neoclassical with its traditional forms, the modern with its new harmonic language, the motor with its powerful rhythms and intense repetitions, and of course, the lyrical. He also mentions a jesting or scherzo-ish quality, which he says is not so much an independent line as a deviation from each of the others. These are all present in the concerto and in the 10 piano miniatures that he recorded in Paris in 1935. Here's the shortest of his Opus 22, Vision Fugitive. The title comes from the Russian poet Konstantin Balmont, who wrote, "In every fugitive vision, I see worlds full of the changing plays of rainbow hues." Prokofiev was born in Russia, but after 1918 traveled to Western Europe and the United States and settled in Paris in 1922. But by 1935, he resettled in Russia and remained an important Soviet figure until his death in 1953. Perhaps if he had stayed longer in Western Europe, he might have recorded more of his own work than the total of 57 minutes and 10 seconds of music that fit all too easily on this single compact disc.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Prokofiev Plays Prokofiev on the Pearl Label. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Actress Claire Bloom has shared the stage with many great performers, actors like Charlie Chaplin, Richard Burton, and John Gielgud. Now she's taking to the stage all by herself, portraying some of literature's great heroines. Coming up, we meet Claire Bloom. And book critic John Leonard reviews the latest novel from Anne Tyler, who wrote the bestseller, The Accidental Tourist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At the UN, the UN Secretary General says that the government of El Salvador and rebel forces have signed a peace agreement aimed at ending a 12-year-old civil war. Secretary General Perez de Cuellar says this new agreement covers the conditions for integrating the rebels into the political process in El Salvador and provides guarantees for their safety. Also, the UN Security Council has approved a resolution calling for a ban on arms sales to Yugoslavia. Linda Fasula reports.
The council meeting opened with the Yugoslavian foreign minister welcoming action by the world body and closed with the imposition of a global embargo on all weapons and military equipment to the country. 11 foreign ministers, including Secretary of State James Baker, participated in the vote. The resolution endorses the peace efforts of the European community, particularly the use of ceasefire observers to help end the hostilities. It calls on the UN Secretary General to offer his assistance without delay and to report back to the Council as soon as possible. All factions are strongly urged to abide strictly by recent ceasefire agreements and to come together for peace talks. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate has voted 51-48 to continue production of the B-2 stealth bomber, despite questions about its ability to evade enemy radar. The vote came on a proposal to save $3.2 billion by halting production of the airplane after the 15 already authorized by Congress. The chief Republican sponsor of a compromise civil rights bill took to the floor of the Senate today to criticize the White House for playing what he termed racial politics. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Missouri Republican John Danforth has been trying to find a compromise civil rights bill that will be acceptable to both the White House and Congress. Yesterday, he announced a new version of the bill. It is designed to overcome White House objections by using language lifted from a civil rights measure the White House had supported, the Americans with Disabilities Act. But the White House rejected Danforth's latest attempt, saying it, too, was a quota bill. Critics of the president say his use of the quota issue is designed to exploit fears of lower-income white voters that civil rights legislation will lead to less qualified blacks taking away their jobs. Today, Danforth said race politics is not only bad for the Republican Party, it's bad for the country. Danforth's civil rights bill is expected to come up in the Senate within the next 2 weeks. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 8 points to close at 3,021.02 on volume of some 154 million shares. This is NPR News. The White House says that all options are open in regard to Iraq's detention of UN inspectors. As for a pledge by Iraq to allow UN helicopter flights to search for weapons, a spokesman says that the president is putting on hold a threat to provide U.S. escorts for those helicopters. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is said to be planning to send back to the Persian Gulf region Air Force Lieutenant General Charles Horner, who commanded U.S. bombing of Iraq in the Persian Gulf War. A special advisor to PLO Chief Yasser Arafat has told the PLO parliament meeting in Algiers it must seize the opportunity for peace in the Middle East, as he believes Washington is serious in its intention to try to bring about the end of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Alf Hermida reports from Algiers.
Bassam Abu Sharif told delegates that it was their historic duty to participate in the peace process, regardless of vested interests. He warned there was a real danger that the Palestinians would lose the occupied territories to the flow of Jewish immigrants if the PLO didn't act now. Abu Sharif said he believed President Bush was serious in his commitment to try to bring about an end to occupation, and this presented the PLO with a viable opportunity to reach a political settlement. He told delegates the halting of the building of new settlements in the occupied territories was a necessary prerequisite to taking part in the peace conference. As regards other conditions, such as the question of Palestinian representation, Abu Sharif said this was a side issue. He called for the PLO's ruling executive to unite in its aims and act as a decision-making body and not the debating club it now is. For National Public Radio, this is Alf Hamida in Algiers.
Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton will announce next week if he will be a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. Clinton, who is expected to enter the race, has scheduled a news conference for October 3rd in downtown Little Rock. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Actress Claire Bloom has played many of the great roles, Ophelia in Hamlet, Juliet, Nora in A Doll's House, and Hedda Gabler. Much of her career has been spent on the London stage, where she's worked with the great actors Laurence Olivier, John Gielgud, and Paul Scofield. These days, Bloom lives in the United States with her husband, novelist Philip Roth. She's been appearing in films and has worked with Woody Allen in Crimes and Misdemeanors and with Stephen Frears in Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. This week, Bloom is appearing on the stage at Symphony Space in New York in a program called Women Observed, Four Dramatic Portraits of Passionate Women from Literature. It's a one-woman show with Bloom performing segments from Jane Eyre, Anna Karenina, The Turn of the Screw, A Room of One's Own, and Mrs. Dalloway. I asked her what attracted her to these particular women.
First of all, the whole idea was to present great novels, obviously abridged, but in their entirety as far as the story goes. I then had to find what I considered a great novel, a first-rate novel, and one that has as its central character a woman, because I didn't fancy myself as Captain Ahab or Lord Jim. So that immediately confines one to a certain literature. From that, I have chosen slowly because some of these readings these performances, I'd prefer to call them, I've done before. Anna Karenina, I'm doing for the first time. I chose women that I thought were complex, interesting, and to be extremely pragmatic, that were dramatizable.
What's so compelling about doing a one-woman show?
I've done them now for a long time. I do two Shakespeare separate performances, and I've been doing these. And for an actor, it gives you the flexibility to hold your life in your own hands and not wait for the telephone to ring to be offered a role. That's the basic. So that you can do it when you like, in interesting places. But the excitement is that you have to hold an audience for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, by yourself. It's a terrific challenge. And the concentration required is enormous, from you and I think from them.
We often hear of actresses, and I think this has been an ongoing problem, complaining about the lack of female roles, or even some of the narrow characterizations often offered to female actors. Is this your way, then, of creating it and performing it yourself, a way of making something happen that might not be offered to you?
Well, it isn't so much that it won't be offered to me, but that it isn't done. I mean, literature, let's face it, is not central to the theater as it is now. In fact, the theater as it is now pretty well doesn't exist. So what remains? The other things that I do, television and film, yes, very, very occasionally you get something like Brideshead Revisited that I did, which is taken from not a great novel, but certainly a wonderful novel. But this is your chance to create the great, great characters. And yes, there is your Cleopatra or Mrs. Alving, or, you know, there are some very wonderful roles for women, and I don't mean for children. But this is something else. These are really the big stuff. Big time.
The big stuff meaning it's classics. It's from the classics.
No, I don't mean that. It makes it sound dead. I mean it's big, psychologically involved, emotional, attack that's required a complex understanding of an extremely psychologically complex woman like Anna Karenina or the governess in The Turn of the Screw, who's completely cracked, and you have to chart her course through this terrible journey she makes from the time she comes to this house to the time the boy dies. You go on enormous journeys with these women that very rarely in theatrical terms are you offered such a journey. I've made those journeys, and I've played Nora, and I've played Hedda, and I've played Blanche DuBois and Juliet and all those, but this is those great roles are indeed rare, much rarer for women than for men.
When did you begin to have acting lessons? When did you start to act?
I didn't really have many acting lessons. My aunt was a rather famous actress in England. I always wanted to be an actress. I acted at school. I don't remember anything about school. In fact, I met a cousin the other day who was with me at school, and she remembered all kinds of things, and all I remembered was playing the princess in Rumpelstiltskin. So that was the only thing that interested me. Now, thank goodness, I have other interests too, but that was it, and that was what I wanted to do, and that was what I did. I did go to something called a wonderful place called the Guildhall School of Music and Drama for a year, and I went to the Central School for a year. But then I was offered a professional job by the BBC, and I was told by the Central School I had to choose them or us, and I said, "Well, thank you, goodbye." So I didn't have much training. I trained by seeing great theatre and doing little parts and walk-ons and understudies and. You know, that's the other way to go about it.
Well, I know that during World War II, during really the Blitz of London, you came to the United States to get out from underneath the bombing there. This, I assume, was the British War Relief effort brought you over here.
That's right, yes.
And you really felt that at that point in your life, your childhood had ended. That I guess being brought to this country and being taken from your father, that somehow brought the end of your childhood.
Yeah, I had to grow up fast. Yes. We all did. I mean, I think that it's an interesting subject, evacuees from England, because after all, we were not from a country that was invaded, or we thought we were going to be, which is why we left. But most of us, I didn't leave of my own free will because I was 9, and I've always been slightly ashamed of it, funnily enough.
Why?
Because other people didn't, you know. The thing is, my parents were told by the government, if you have a sponsor in America or a relative, send your children out. So they did. But we actually went back in 1943 through Portugal. I don't know why. I just always have.
People, I think, have always assumed, and perhaps it's from the sound of your voice and even your look, that somehow you came from the British aristocracy.
Who assumes that?
Well, this is what I have read people saying about you.
Oh, how terrific.
And it was a theme in certainly reading about you.
There's never been an actress, you know, who's come from the so-called aristocracy, whatever that is. Most actresses are middle class, as I am, and working class. Aristocracy does not breed actors. You have to be totally unsure of yourself and longing for acceptance and to create yourself in some other form and not be all that pleased with who you are. Anyway, I know nothing about aristocrats, so I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
I did, however, play one once in Brideshead Revisited, and I thought, well, this is a world I don't know a damn thing about. Mm. And then I did have one friend who is, and I thought, well, I better watch her and do what she does, that's all. And it worked. I won't say who she is. So that's as near as I come.
I'm speaking with Claire Bloom, and she is, of course, an actress with a long and distinguished acting career, and she'll perform her one-woman show called Women Observe later this week and weekend in New York City at Symphony Space. And we will take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with actress Claire Bloom. When did you begin your film career?
With Limelight, with Chaplin. Nobody can begin with a greater flourish of drums and trumpets.
How did you catch his eye, his attention?
I was in a play in London. I was 19, and I was doing a play called Ring Round the Moon, where I played a dancer. And I had been trained as a dancer, but I was never good enough, and I certainly never danced. But I could move like one. I only say that because it's important to the film. And Chaplin was looking for someone small, dark, English, young, and who either was a dancer or could look like one. Well, I fitted all those things, but, I mean, there I was in London, and I knew nothing about this at all. A friend of his, the playwright Arthur Lawrence, came to see the play. Apparently, this is how it happened, recommended me to Chaplin. And then I got a wire from Chaplin asking me to send photographs, which I did. And then there was a long pause. And then he asked me to come and test with him, which I did. And then I waited 3 months and I had the role.
What was it like to play opposite him?
Like nothing in the world could ever be again. I'm afraid I hit the tops very early. It was a magical, superb experience. And I was the most fortunate young actress in the world.
Did he expect a kind of obedience from his actors and actresses? Did he expect them to do what he said?
Yes, he did, and I happily did it. It was all right. Everything he said was correct. Yes, he did.
You were young, as you say. You were about age 19, and this was your first film. Do you think you would have been so obedient if you worked with him today?
If it was Chaplin, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, no question. If, you know, I would very happily, as an actress, put myself in the hands of somebody I trusted. The trouble is there are not that many people you trust. But it's rather wonderful, you know, you just know that you have the most wonderful guide and critic, and that you can't actually go wrong, because somebody will stop you and put you on the right track. It's unfortunately fairly rare, but I had it with him, and yes, I would do it when I'm 103.
I know it's unfair to talk to an actor about their acting style, but there is something that you did say in your autobiography about the kind of acting temperament, I guess, that you have. And you talk about wanting or working towards a performance totally in control of uncontrollable emotions rather than a performance that displays everything.
You know, that was 10 years ago, and even now one changes. I really would have to say that one adapts oneself to the role. And yes, of course it is true that if you cry, the audience doesn't. But that's not altogether true. I think you have to be... You see, I didn't mean that you weren't involved emotionally in what you were doing. Though I know you didn't say that.
No.
I did say that.
No.
I'm just trying to define what I meant, actually. Yes, you have to be in control of the emotions. You can't let them all over the place. That's perfectly true. You have to channel them into their most powerful form. And that means that though part of you experiences the emotion, the other part has to be in control. That's absolutely true. I do believe that. I think every actor does. After all, you can't perform, not that I want to anymore, but you can't perform 8 times a week. And let your guts spill out. The nearest I did that was in Blanche DuBois, and I, along with, I think, nearly every actress who played it, paid for it for a long time afterwards in terms of their health. You can't play that part otherwise. You play it on the edge of your nerves all the time, and you actually cannot play that part otherwise. You just have to do it every night like that.
How did you pay for that role with your health?
Well, I was very thin and underweight and hideous and exhausted and emotional. I won't say I had a nervous breakdown because I don't think it was that. But I had a year of kind of ill health. But it's so did Vivian Leigh, and it's a very dangerous part, funnily enough. It enters into your life very much. In some way, which I find hard to explain, but it does.
Does that make that a favorite part for you? I mean, it sounds like you're paying a terrible price in a way.
It was worth every penny. Yeah. It's the greatest part I've ever played, and I actually think the best performance I ever gave. And I'd do it again, yes. Tomorrow.
Can you tell us why it was your favorite part?
Every line, every second, every moment, every minute, everything is perfect. It's the most extraordinary play in terms of the story, the richness of the story, the confrontations between Mitch and Blanche and Stanley and Blanche, Stella and Blanche. Her, the terrible kind of downward spiral of her emotional self during the play to her going off to the lunatic asylum in the end. And the language is so beautiful and the music and everything about it, the atmosphere of it that Tennessee Williams created was absolute perfection. It's a very great, great role.
There's a chapter in your autobiography called The Worst of It, talking about the fact that unemployment is part of being employed as an actor or actress, that even the best actress and actor has time off, time in between roles. Does that get any easier when you have the kind of body of work that you have, that the lull between performances gets easier just because you have acted in so many productions?
Oh, immensely easier. First of all, I mean, anyone who, you know, after a certain age sits and waits for the telephone to ring really has to have their head tested, because that's not a way to live. Secondly, yes, there is one nice thing that comes with getting older, and I can say I've done practically everything I wanted to do. But the other thing goes back to the very beginning of our conversation. Why am I doing these performances? Because I don't like to be someone who is passive and sits and waits for the phone to ring. I think it's an infantilizing, horrible situation to be in. Now, the fact is that, yes, the phone rings, but it can very well be, you know, things you really don't want to do. So I now have the wonderful position of saying, sorry, but I'm going to Boston to do four performances next week, and I'm not free.
Claire Bloom, thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Not at all.
Claire Bloom is appearing in her one-woman show later this week at Symphony Space in New York City. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Marty. The nuclear siege in Iraq, the nuclear inspectors from the United Nations who are holed up in a parking lot in Baghdad, that is threatening to go into its second night. We're going to take a look at what the administration's options are and ask some experts what those documents might contain. We have the report from the National Commission on AIDS. I get together a group of experts and ask some questions about AIDS and public health. And we are going to take note tonight of the sad news that Dr. Seuss is dead.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Novelist Anne Tyler writes about the friction within families. Critic John Leonard has a review of her new book, St. Maybe.
Each of Anne Tyler's devoted readers seems to have a different favorite Tyler novel. Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant, usually, or Breathing Lessons. I'm partial to Morgan's Passing, with its magician and its puppeteer. But I've begun to feel these enthusiasms are arbitrary. We can tune in anywhere, anytime, to Tyler's dream radio, late at night from Baltimore, and eavesdrop on yet another family going crazy, hear about the stay-at-homes and runaways, smile and cry and fall into her gravity and grace. It's not that the novels are interchangeable, but one or another meets a particular mood or need, like a blues lyric or a Woody Allen movie. Tyler herself just goes on humming in our ear, telling more secrets. I shouldn't be as interested as I was in the bedlows of St. Maybe. They don't read, they don't even go to movies. All they do is suffer and cope. But when Grandma B cries out in despair, it hurts. Sometimes I have the strangest feeling, she says. I give this start and I think, why, here we are, just going about our business the same as usual. And yet so much has changed. Our lives have turned so makeshift and second class, so second string, so second fiddle, and everything's been lost. Isn't it amazing that we keep on going, that we keep on shopping for clothes and getting hungry and laughing at jokes on TV, when our oldest son is dead and gone and we'll never see him again, and our life's in ruins? Their oldest son is Danny Bedloe, who may or may not have killed himself when his younger brother Ian told him something about Danny's wife, Lucy, that may or may not have been true. Lucy will kill herself too. Ian, consumed with guilt and born again in the Church of the Second Chance, quits college and goes to work as a carpenter to care for the three children left behind. Ian is Saint Maybe. Mostly, he's as passive and fatalistic as Charlotte in Earthly Possessions, or Emily in Morgan's Passing. Nor, in spite of his carpentry, is he a Christ figure. Ian's not so sure Jesus really was a carpenter, not with the muscles he sees in the paintings. When two of Lucy's kids grow up enough to run away to California and New York, Ian at last gets married to someone a little too much like Muriel in The Accidental Tourist. Even then, he marries Rita because he thinks she's invulnerable, someone who couldn't be harmed. It sounds soap operatic, doesn't it? With the extra ingredient of God, as if Anne Tyler were trying to please John Updike, who has always wanted her to be more like Flannery O'Connor. And yet I like these people, even the Reverend Emmett at the Church of the Second Chance. Ian is a terrific father to children who deserve to be loved. Tyler touches each of them with her sword, and they shine. She confers, even on the routine and the peripheral, a mysterious twilight grace. Ian's own father, for instance, a retired teacher, hangs out with the gadget-happy foreign students across the street. The best thing about these foreigners, he says, was how they thought living in America was a story they were reading or a movie they were watching. It was happening to someone else. It wasn't theirs. Here they spoke lines invented by other people, not genuine language, not the language that simply is, with no need for translation. But Tyler's America happens to all of us, in magical translation. She's as wicked as Jane Austen, as generous as Chekhov.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Anne Tyler's new book, Saint Maybe. Our arts reviews this week are produced by Sue Spolin and Roberta Shorrock. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music is composed and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Marty Moscoane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, we talk sex with Dr. June Reinisch, the director of the Kinsey Institute. She'll discuss what she calls America's sexual illiteracy. Also, we meet real-life private eye, Hal Lipsett. That and more on the next Fresh Air.